South Dakota tourist sites stand the test of time. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Friday, June 25th, and this is In the Moment. The state's tourism mainstays like Wild Drug and the Reptile Gardens, the Pioneer Auto Show, are thriving after the pandemic. South Dakota Magazine's Bernie Hunhoff and author Paul Higby join us later this hour to share what keeps travelers returning year after year. But first, we discuss a recent Supreme Court case that limits law enforcement entering homes in certain situations. And Kent Osborne and Amos Asip join us for Tech Radio to discuss Windows 11, the latest from the JBS cybersecurity attack, and why you really do need to back up your data. We're broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio inside SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. I'm Jackie Hendry, in for Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Over the next 18 months, the White House will meet with several cities across the country, including Rapid City, about police intervention programs. It's part of a strategy to reduce gun violence. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has more.
The White House says it anticipates a rise in gun violence this summer. It's looking to communities like Rapid City, which are invested in community violence intervention. Rapid City is the smallest community involved. Rapid City Mayor Steve Allender met with President Joe Biden earlier this week as part of a roundtable discussion in Washington, D.C. Allender says a lot of the president's initiative focuses on bigger cities.
And I told him this, with one important exception, that this focuses on community violence intervention. It focuses on identifying offenders and confronting them, partnering with them, and mentoring them prior to them committing crimes.
That's something Allender supports. The White House is looking to invest in more community violence intervention programs. Allender says he mentioned several programs Rapid City is involved in, including the Care Campus, operated by Pennington County, which provides economic aid, substance abuse treatment, and a safe place for intoxicated people to sleep. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
A law legalizing recreational marijuana will remain in limbo on its scheduled effective date of July 1st. That's according to the state Supreme Court administrator. At issue is whether voter-approved Amendment A violates the state constitution. Governor Kristi Noem and Pennington County Sheriff Kevin Thome filed the lawsuit, and the Supreme Court has it under consideration. One voter-approved marijuana question will become law next week. Initiated Measure 26 sets up a medical marijuana program. Pennington County State's Attorney Mark Vargo says his office is getting ready for that.
We understand that IM 26 is taking effect on July 1st, and so we're really working with that as our benchmark, and you know, we'll deal the collateral impacts of Amendment A, we'll deal with those when they come around.
State lawmakers continue to study how medical and recreational marijuana will affect state law. The Republican chair of an adult-use marijuana subcommittee says if the Supreme Court strikes down Amendment A, the committee will write a proposal to legalize pot next year. Medical marijuana won't be allowed on the campuses of South Dakota's public universities. The Board of Regents changed its policy on medical marijuana as the state prepares for the drug to be legalized. It reasoned that it had to stay in compliance with federal law, which still outlaws the drug. The new policy does not stop university students or employees from ingesting medical pot on property not controlled or owned by the board, but threatens to discipline students and employees who are impaired while in class or at their jobs. South Dakota's Attorney General wants to keep cameras and audio recording devices out of the courtroom when he goes on trial in connection with the death of a man along a Hyde County highway. Jason Roundsburg faces three misdemeanor charges related to his driving the night he struck and killed Joe Beaver. A court document recently filed on behalf of Roundsburg objects to cameras or audio recordings during his trial, which is scheduled to start August 26th. For weather today, we're seeing mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers in the northeast. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Jackie Hendry, in for Lori Walsh. The Supreme Court of the United States recently ruled that police can't always enter homes when pursuing someone for minor crimes. But what exactly does that ruling mean for the public, and what doesn't it mean? Mike Thompson is Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Sioux Falls. He joins me in the Kirby Family Studio in our Sioux Falls studio to discuss the case and help clear up some questions. Mike Thompson, welcome to In the Moment.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just start by illustrating this case. What went down?
Mr. Lang drove by a police officer, had his windows down, playing loud music. This was in Sonoma, California. Playing loud music, the officer began to follow him. Officer activated his lights to have him pull over. Mr. Lang did not observe that that signal and continued to his home, which was about a four-minute drive from where the officer started tailing him. Drove into his garage, which is attached to his house, and the officer followed him into the garage, questioned him, and eventually arrested him for DWI. So that's how the case originated. Then his attorney asked the judge to declare, the California State Court judge, to declare that that search, that entry, was unreasonable, therefore unconstitutional. Any evidence of the DWI should be thrown out under the exclusionary rule. Yeah.
Interesting.
It is.
So this is one of those stories when you read it and you think, really, this happens? And maybe some people aren't as surprised as I am, but it's one of those where it's like, really, we had to go all the way up for something like this? There really was no precedent or anything? Outline kind of that journey for us.
Good question. A couple of background notes. The Fourth Amendment to the Constitution really, and this is in Supreme Court precedent, protects the sanctity of the home. That is the first consideration of the Fourth Amendment. So the court is always leery about warrantless entries into homes and prefers officers to get a warrant if they can. So in the situation of a felony, if an arrest is commenced and a person flees and the crime is a felony, which is in South Dakota is a crime punishable by more than a year in a state penitentiary, the flight itself from that arrest is enough of an emergent circumstance to allow a warrantless entry into a home. That is pretty close to a categorical rule, which means that is always the case. In this one, the crime is a misdemeanor. And I think it's important to remember that the officer didn't have probable cause to arrest Mr. Lang for DWI during the time when Mr. Lang was eluding him. He only had probable cause to arrest him for eluding. So that misdemeanor, whether we can pursue a misdemeanant into a home, was the question presented here. The court has, in prior cases, allowed officers to make warrantless entries into homes based on probable cause to arrest for a misdemeanor. When somebody's life is in danger, when officers can see that people are fighting inside, when there might be evidence destroyed. So entries have been allowed into homes in the past. The reason this case made it all the way to the Supreme Court is that the California court said that flight from a misdemeanor arrest always is an emergency circumstance allowing a warrantless entry into a home.
I see.
That's what the Supreme Court has a problem with, that categorical rule.
Interesting. So is that going to change kind of state by state, whether or not what constitutes a minor versus a major kind of situation?
No, great point. This case is decided on the U.S. Constitution. The Fourth Amendment, when it was originally ratified, applied only to the federal government. The 14th, though, the court has used that to apply the Fourth Amendment to the states. So when the Supreme Court makes this decision, that applies nationwide. The court is saying no state can have a categorical rule that allows a warrantless home entry based on probable cause to arrest for a misdemeanor.
So let's say after this ruling, if I, for whatever reason, find myself in a very similar situation to Mr. Lang after this ruling, what is a citizen's kind of recourse if they find themselves in that situation? Is that something that you can speak to at all?
Oh, sure. If if, in Mr. Lang's case, for example, if the officer violates his constitutional rights, Mr. Lang can use what's called a 1983 action, and the 1983 refers to a section of federal statutory law that allows people to sue governmental employees for constitutional rights violations. So Mr. Lang could or a citizen can sue an officer for money damages for violating a constitutional right.
Interesting. In our last minute or so together, are there any other U.S. Supreme Court cases that you're kind of keeping an ear to or that are of interest?
Right. Lori and I have discussed some over the court's term. There's a stop case out of that was on tribal land in Montana. That's been decided. That's an interesting question. Usually the criminal justice cases are the ones I'm trying to keep track of.
Right.
Yeah, so this is an interesting case.
An intriguing time. Our guest has been Mike Thompson, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Sioux Falls. Mike Thompson, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after the break, SDPB's Richard Tubles tells us about a unique partnership that brought the first fire department to the Pine Ridge Reservation. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Before First Dakota filed its charter in 1872, there wasn't a bank in South Dakota. What will be your South Dakota first? FirstDakota.com/first.
Every story has a beginning. Think back to when your journey with SDPB began. Was it waking up with Morning Edition? Finishing your day with Jazz Nightly? SDPB is your constant companion during your commute, whether that is across town or across the state, informing you in times of crisis, or beginning a relaxing weekend with laughter on Saturday morning. SDPB has been part of the fabric of South Dakota for nearly a century, and SDPB is part of your story. I'm Ryan Howlett, the Development Director at Friends of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. This week, we're asking for your support to continue to make outstanding news and entertainment on the radio. Please consider a gift. You can do so online at sdpb.org/donate or by calling 800-333-0789. SDPB, building community one story at a time.
Program funding by the Sanford Underground Research Facility, supporting public outreach through its free science festival, Neutrino Day, Star Chronicles. Join the fun in our virtual science town July 9th through the 10th. More at neutrinoday.com and sanfordlab.org.
Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Jackie Hendry, in for Lori Walsh. The Oglala Lakota Tribe on the Pine Ridge Reservation has never had a dedicated structural fire department to serve its residents. The nearest response time for house fires could be up to an hour, leaving victims to watch their house and possessions burn to the ground. But all that is about to change for the tribe as they develop unique partnerships to get this structural fire department off the ground. SDPB's Richard Tubles joins us in the Black Hills studio for more. Richard, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Hello, Jackie. Thank you for having me. So, you know, this has been something that the tribe's been working on for years, and I had a great talk with Wesley Big Crow, the fire chief of the Ogallala Lakota Structural Fire Department. He said there are quite a few misconceptions when it comes to structural fires on the reservation.
You talk about fire, and everybody always says, well, fire is the BIA takes care of that. Well, the BIA doesn't take care of it. The BIA takes care of wildland fire only. And not having a structural fire department on this reservation for the entirety of my life or even anybody else's life. You know, there's never been one here. We've always had to look for outside resources, which is all the volunteer fire departments around our reservation.
And Richard, that's an important distinction, a structural fire department versus, you know, a wildfire or something like that. So I'm hearing the big issue here is a response time issue. That's the biggest disadvantage. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, you know, the biggest difference between wildland and structural, you know, obviously the BIA takes care of wildland, like Wesley said, and it's too much of a liability for them to fight structural fires. So, you know, like Wesley said, they have to rely on volunteer fire departments from places like Bateson or Martin. And Jackie, if there's a fire in Oglala, it could take up to an hour or more for those first responders to get there. And after setting up the groundwork for some initial funding, this unique partnership was struck up with the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. I spoke with a former mine student, William Smith, who graduated recently, actually, and he was part of the team that kind of helped with the project.
It's a really it's kind of cool and rewarding feeling. It's something I can't really maybe even put into words. As a student, you know, you're very limited in your knowledge and experience in engineering. I mean, you have the basic principles that you're learning through school, but, you know, the application part of it is still very new. So the opportunity to have that experience and, like, not only just part of, you know, a standard project, but something that's kind of moving in a way and, you know, establishing something that's really going to make a positive impact in a community that's in much need of it.
Yeah, so Jackie, not only are the students able to benefit from it with what they're seeking in their degrees from School of Mines, but the school is able to secure a USDA rural development grant that seeks to improve infrastructure in rural communities. And they also went as far as holding town hall meetings in each district of the tribe. And according to Big Crow, the people knew exactly what they wanted.
You know, what would you guys like to see? And a lot of the input was, we'd just like to see some kind of fire suppression here. You know, we would like to have our own fire trucks in our own district. You know, so response time, because, you know, calling people and then, you know, an hour later, our trailer's burnt completely down, our house is burnt completely down, you know, and we're losing everything. So all they would like is just a fire department in their district. So we came up with the design, and, you know, it's two bays. You know, we got four extensions to our big, our administration building, and our headquarters is going to be in Pine Ridge. It's about a 10,000 square foot building. It's got office space in there for our administration, and it's got five bays for our fire trucks.
So Richard, we're still in the architectural phase right now, kind of the planning phase for this. But once it's all said and done, there's the structural fire department in Oglala. Is that going to provide some kind of economic development as well?
Yeah, you know, I think right now, obviously, they're trying to get the building constructed. It's still in that development phase. And, you know, I think the biggest goal, you know, is to start out as a volunteer fire department. But Big Crow said that the long-term goal is to provide full-time jobs to, you know, aspiring firefighters.
All Native American, you know, young boys and girls, you know, because I used to work at the Bureau of Indian Affairs before I started here. It was, these kids are all hands-on kids, you know, and this is a hands-on project. This is the way they learn with their hands and their eyes, you know. And so having a fire department gives these kids an opportunity to have a career in something, and they can take it off reservation. My thing is if we could get guys trained up here and the young kids come in and say, hey, I want a career in fire and structural fire and wildland fire, they can get it in my program. And then if they decide when they're a little older in their 20s or 30s and they want to go somewhere else and live somewhere else, they have that background of saying, hey, I can go fight fire somewhere else.
You know, Jackie, I think this is going to be a big deal for the tribal members of Pine Ridge because, you know, there is a housing shortage. A lot of these households are holding more than just single nuclear families. Mm. Some have multiple families living in a three-bedroom house, and that's kind of similar across most reservations. And, you know, a fire that burns down a house could be devastating for the people that live there, you know, all these multiple family members. And, you know, when it comes to fires, prevention is always key. So this fire department can do major outreach to its district to not only teach fire safety, but stress the importance of fire alarms and fire extinguishers and having an escape plan when there's a house fire. I think it's just going to be a wonderful thing for them down there to have such such a good response time when it comes to structural fires.
Right. It's a safety issue, a resource issue, an economic development issue all wrapped up into one. So kind of an exciting development you brought us today, Richard. You can find more of Richard's reporting on our website, sdpb.org/news. Richard Tubols joined us today from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio. Richard, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Jackie.
Coming up, we talk data security and the latest operating system for Microsoft. Amos Asup and Kent Osborne join us for Tech Radio just ahead. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Program funding by Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda in Rapid City, inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda. See you at Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda, Rapid City.
Every story has a beginning. Think back to when your journey with SDPB began. Was it waking up with Morning Edition? Finishing your day with Jazz Nightly? SDPB is your constant companion during your commute, whether that is across town or across the state, informing you in times of crisis, or beginning a relaxing weekend with laughter on Saturday morning. SDPB has been part of the fabric of South Dakota for nearly a century, and SDPB is part of your story. I'm Ryan Hallett, the Development Director at Friends of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. This week, we're asking for your support to continue to make outstanding news and entertainment on the radio. Please consider a gift. You can do so online at sdpb.org/donate or by calling 800-333-0789. SDPB, building community one story at a time.
Program funding by the Sanford Underground Research Facility, supporting public outreach through its free science festival, Neutrino Day, Star Chronicles. Join the fun in our virtual science town July 9th through the 10th. More at neutrinoday.com and sanfordlab.org.
Science and technology reporting is supported by Black Hills Information Security.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. Sure, Microsoft said Windows 10 was their last operating system, but what's the fun in that anyway? It's time now for Tech Radio, when we discuss the latest in technology news. We're joined now by SDPB's Kent Osborne. Kent, welcome back to the program.
Hey, great to be here.
Also, Amos Asup, Chief Information Security Officer at Exigent Solutions here in the Kirby Family Studio. Amos, welcome back to you as well.
Okay, glad to be here.
Let's start off with this big Windows 10 event. Just heard some more at an event yesterday. Like we said, Microsoft said 10 was it, but clearly not. Kent, bring us up to speed on what's happening here.
Oh, boy. Yeah, so, you know, I don't know if anybody really believed it back then, but... but yeah, Windows 10 was supposed to be it. And I mean, you know, so some key takeaways here. The good news is it's going to be a free upgrade. The caveat is you need to meet the new specs that they'll release for the computer. So the right amount of, you know, the right processor is going to need 2 cores, and it's going to need so much RAM. And the biggest thing, the biggest hurdle for a lot of folks is going to be 64-bit operating system. So you just need to have the proper processor and the proper computer, a new enough machine that's going to be able to upgrade to Windows 11. Then it's going to be free for you. And, you know, supposed improvements to, you know, everything from, you know, they made a big deal about how, you know, updates are going to be smaller and easier and lighter and everything. And I'm like, oh, that's great on your end. I really don't care. I just get auto updates. So the fact that you're making them faster and smaller, I really don't care. But, you know, we'll just have to kind of wait and see. Amos, what were your key takeaways? Anything on the security side you could see?
You know, not a tremendous amount. I mean, the information is pretty limited at this point anyway. In fact, there's still some folks out there who are even questioning whether it's going to be, you know, Windows 11, you know, as a title, right, or as a brand. And at this point, the way Microsoft has been rolling out updates for Windows 10, and we have all of these release versions, I don't know what the big benefit is of naming it a new OS. you know, where they could, it seems like every time I get a new update to my computer, it's something, the machine is completely different. Like the last one where I have the weather down in the bottom right hand corner, right? I mean, that was a great release. The information is a little bit sparse at this point, but I agree, Kent. Who really thought that they were going to say telling the truth when it was the last Windows? I mean, this is their bread and butter. This is how they make their money. This is their flagship product. So I would be surprised if this ever ends.
It will never end.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's just too ubiquitous. There's too many installations, and to force people to move into something that would be completely different, I would be surprised if that's well received.
Right. Are we seeing any like real major changes as far as interface or anything with this that would really get anyone very excited, or is it just kind of, oh, here's another one?
Minor UI designs. You know, their goal is simplicity is what they're saying. How that works out is yet to be seen.
The most curious thing is they're moving the Windows button over into the middle of the screen.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
So it you know, brings your focus to the attention of the thing, you know, and it's like, well, that's kind of goofy. So you're going to have, you know, these little windows you can open on the left, and then there's going to be some on the right. And yeah, it's, I don't know. I hope we can disable that. Just leave it the way it was.
Well, you know, people will come out with programs that say, take your Windows 11 back to look like Windows 10 or even Windows 8 or 7 or whatever, how far apart you want to go back.
Right.
You know, every time they do make a major UI change, somebody comes up with a program that allows you to revert back. And in some cases, that's great. There are some people who just, whether it's for, you know, just personal reasons, that would be they're just anti moving to something new, or they just don't get it. There might be reasons to want to continue to keep that.
Maybe
same
it'll run a
design.
Windows Vista emulator for me,
right,
so I can go back to those days.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the big things that I think the people that use multiple monitors for are looking forward to is there's supposed to be improvements to what happens if, say, you undock your laptop and you've got multiple monitors, and it's been a little wonky as a multiple monitor user.
Mm-hmm.
That they're supposed to be fixing some of that, so hopefully that's going to be good news.
I guess the biggest thing that I saw from a business perspective is Teams, the integration of Teams into everything. Microsoft wants Microsoft Teams to be as ubiquitous as FaceTime is on Apple products, right? But they also want it to be cross-platform compatible. They want it to be on Android. They want it to be available for Mac. And it's a good idea because, you know, I have lots of friends who do the FaceTime thing, but because I don't have an Apple phone, I can't participate. So, but we'll see if those Apple people are willing to put a Microsoft product on their phone.
Exactly. Especially right? As we're seeing, like, I personally know more and more people who are deciding that work from home works great for them. They're going to keep doing it moving forward. So having that cross-platform bit is a plus for sure. We'll shift now. We've been hearing, obviously, the JBS cyber attack making big headlines around the nation, more about cybersecurity at top of mind. Amos, bring us up, if we haven't delved beyond the headlines, kind of, well, what happened and what does this mean for the everyday person?
Right. Well, JBS, the world's largest meat processing company, I guess, it got hit by the same type of malware that Colonial did, right, that we heard about with the pipeline and the shutdown and the gas shortages. You know, when we first heard about this in the security realm, there was lots of giggling about how people were going to run out and start panic buying meat. And I guess in some places that did happen, although I think to a lesser extent. So ransomware, which is just a terrible, terrible development in the computer industry, and there's a couple of versions, right? There's ransomware that steals the data and makes it inaccessible, which is what happened to JBS here, right? You can't move forward, you can't do processing or orders or shipping or whatever. There is a way around that in the cybersecurity industry, which is to make sure you have a backup of everything. And if you make our data inaccessible, we'll bring that backup from our cold storage and we'll put it back in place and we're up and ready to go again. So they've introduced a new variant, which is to not only keep your data from you having it, but if you don't pay the ransomware to threaten to release it to the public and any personal information that would be in there, and just basically embarrass you. And so that's been, you know, a development that's happened recently. But, you know, the alternative, like Colonial paying that $4 million is that's a hefty fine. Mm-hmm. For things that can be fixed. In the Colonial instance, it was a lack of proper authentication. I actually haven't heard what the reason was or what the problem was behind the JBS attack, but in most cases, it is not a hard process to stay safe from ransomware.
Wow. Kent, do you have anything to add on the JBS cybersecurity
Well, it was 11 million for them. up from four.
Ugh.
And yeah, is the thing. You know, it affects my cheeseburger price, and that's, you know, that's one of the things that really upsets me. But it goes far beyond that. You know, we had cattlemen and other people in South Dakota couldn't sell,
right.
You know, and couldn't complete their processes they needed to do in their everyday lives. And that's what hurts so bad about the these cyber attacks is they're going after ag now. They've already stated they're going to, you know, all these different places they're going after. And this is they're Russian-speaking gang. I guess they can't come out and say they're Russians, so they just have to say they're Russian-speaking are the folks that are doing this. And they've got an agenda, and, you know, and it's making a lot of money is part of it. Mm-hmm. And that's so, you know, Amos, as soon as you can get this fixed, let me know. Well, yeah,
right.
Can you get on this?
Well, so. You know, and that's the thing is, you know, I mean, we talk to people every day who have ransomware issues, and it always comes down to one small vulnerability where they don't have multi-factor enabled, or they have poor password hygiene. They reuse their password everywhere, or they have data that is stored in a area that requires no authentication at all. Or the most frequent thing is people click on stuff they shouldn't click on. Right? Mm. It comes in your email and it says, this is so-and-so and I need this emergency information. Click here for whatever. And people open up Word documents or Excel, and now you're in trouble. So,
yeah. Training. I mean, really, I talked to a person. He says, "Well, this thing popped up and said I had a virus, so I called the number."
Yeah,
I'm like, "Oh,
yeah."
And yeah, the conversation didn't go well after that.
And those sorts of folks are trying to do the right thing, right? I mean, they're trying be not proactive, but reactive to fix that virus that they quote unquote have. But they just don't know they're making the problem worse.
Yeah, that's really sad. And you know, I had a thing yesterday where it looked like somebody was attempting to get in my Instagram account, which is not a huge deal for me. But I went in and looked at my password and went, you know, while I'm in here, I'm just going to spiff that up a little bit. So it went from, you know, 6 characters to like 29. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm just going to take care of this. So I'm trying to be as proactive as I can when I'm in there messing with things, catch those passwords that really should have been tougher to begin with. And then, you know, as Amos said, multi-factor, it's really a hard lift for people that aren't used to it. Okay. I forgot my phone the other
right.
day. Took my wife to a doctor's appointment. I couldn't get into my email because I couldn't second party authenticate or second factor authenticate to check my email. It's okay. But they're just going to be the new norms, and it's going to keep us all safer and hopefully keep our gas and cheeseburger prices down too. But
that's the important
it's
part.
I'm making light of it, and I'm sorry about that. But there's a whole bunch on the back end that this is costing. It's right. a lot of money, and we just need to do our part. And I was just in the back of my head thinking, Amos, when you were said, you know, we just use it from a backup and we replace. And I'm thinking, man, I hope they didn't have Western Digital Live backup devices.
Yeah, let's jump into that can.
Yeah. So a lot of people, some people that have a certain particular Western Digital, these little books, notebooks, or things that backup books. That I have a couple of them, but they're not the particular ones that have the problem right now. But they're a device that sits on your network, and multiple people on your network can access it. It's called network attached storage. You know, everybody can get into it, and it's kind of backed up in the cloud. It's all encrypted, and they found out that they logged in the other day, and all their data was gone. Somebody executed a backdoor script that said, "Let's just reset this to factory," and lots of people lost a lot of data, and so hopefully those people that have Amos, what do you prefer three backups? Can you go over that again?
Yeah. So the backup rule is 3-2-1, right? And we always try to make things easy to remember. But three copies of your data on two different medium, with one being offsite or physically disconnected from any systems. And so interestingly enough, when I saw this was going to be a topic, I actually hadn't heard of this.
Right.
And I have one of these at home. And so now I need to go home and see if I'm affected. But, you know, that's one of the issues with connected devices and just computers in general, I guess, is that this sort of stuff can happen. So that's why having multiple copies and multiple medium or media is the best idea.
Oof.
If it means a lot to you, it's worth backing up and use Amos's 3-2-1.
Right.
Please.
Our tech radio takeaways, 3-2-1 method, backups on backups, good password hygiene. And we'll see what patches come out for Windows 11 if you really hate it. So those are our takeaways. Our guests have been SDPB's Kent Osborne. Kent, thanks as always for being here.
You bet.
And Amos Asip, Chief Information Security Officer at Exigent Solutions. Amos, thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
And now let's take a moment for poetry. We pause for poetry from Studio 47 with Patrick Hicks. Today, hear a poem by Chris Vondracek.
This is poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Christopher Vondracek. He was born on September 13th, 1984, in Albert Lea, Minnesota. He grew up in Wells, Minnesota. Vondracek went to the University of South Dakota, where he received a BA in 2007 and an MA in 2009. His debut collection of poetry is Rattlesnake Summer, and in it, he sets a poem in all 66 counties of South Dakota. A former reporter for the Washington Times, Vondracek is now a correspondent for Forum News Service. He lives in Washington, D.C. Today's poem is Hanging Out in the Deadwood Library During the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. Even for those who may not be very familiar with South Dakota, it's a safe bet that they've heard about Mount Rushmore, the city of Deadwood, and the famed motorcycle rally in Sturgis. I like how this poem is set in a library. There's a feeling of being detached from what's going on outside. The library is an oasis of calm, while outside, engines roar. One thing to note, in this poem you'll hear reference to someone named Altman. This is Vondracek's friend who was with him that day. This, then, is Hanging Out in the Deadwood Library During the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally by Christopher Vondracek. I wait for Altman in the room with mysterious paperbacks. A librarian shuffles photographs with white gloves. I'm not sure whose trucks those are, she says, of the pickups parked on the street. Down the steep cobblestone to the Silverado, Lawrence County's seat moseys, T-shirts, whiskey, buffalo leather wallets dangling, a rumble, po-po, tato-tato of the Harleys circling like unfed dogs. But inside, the library is quiet, save the woman at the table turning pages of newspapers like watery words filling brooks. It must feel good to set out the newspapers for a day, to see them read, all that news devoured. How many days does the librarian put them back on the shelf unread? Such is the life in a mountain town, though. Everything you want must be supported. Even the houses have stilts. The librarian tips forward on her black laced boots and removes an eyeglass, inspecting a daguerreotype of a miner, his gold grainy tooth, and I look out the window as a man on a motorcycle dips his silver handlebars down Denver Avenue, rolling, rolling, kicking his engine awake just before hitting the intersection.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. This episode was recorded at Augustana University and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
You can find more poetry from Studio 47 at ps47.org. After the break, Bernie Hunhoff and Paul Higby join us to talk about some of South Dakota's thriving roadside attractions. This is In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Program funding by a co-op agreement with the U.S. Small Business Administration. If COVID-19 impacted your business, SDCEO Women's Business Center offers complimentary confidential advice. More at bhsu.edu/SDCEO.
Hi, I'm Julie Overgaard, Executive Director of SDPB. The Sound Vision campaign is allowing us to get the message out of our high-quality programming. SDPB is the golden standard of public broadcasting and is critical to getting the news, stories, and entertainment of South Dakota to South Dakotans. A gift to the Sound Vision campaign will give SDPB the opportunity to reach deeper into our community to share these amazing stories and entertainment. Make a gift to the Sound Vision campaign and help build community one story at a time. Be as generous as you can. No matter the amount, you power this station to serve all of us. You can play a part in guaranteeing that SDPB serves the state for years to come. Give online at sdpb.org/donate or call 800-333-0789. Again, 800-333-0789. And thank you so much for your support.
Program funding with your support and by Ingalls Homestead, Laura's Living Prairie. Sharing Laura Ingalls Wilder's pioneer heritage through covered wagon rides and hands-on activities. Online at IngallsHomestead.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Jackie Hendry, in for Lori Walsh. In South Dakota, tourism managed to do fairly well during the last year. Bernie Hunhoff and Paul Higby together wrote Roadside Thrivers in the new South Dakota magazine, which explores how some of South Dakota's touristy mainstays have stayed afloat. Bernie Hunhoff is editor-at-large for South Dakota Magazine and joins us now by phone. Bernie Hunhoff, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Jackie. Happy to be here.
Also joining us, Paul Higby, a South Dakota author. Paul, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you.
So let's start at the beginning of this piece. This is a handy, lovely, fun summertime road trip kind of piece you've brought us. Bernie, tell us how kind of the origin of this feature.
You know, well, first of all, Paul and I have teamed up on lots of stories through what going on 30, 35 years with the magazine. And, you know, I don't know how many times we've both just driven. Well, we've stopped for chocolate donuts, but how many times we've driven just right on past Waldrug and Murdo Otter Museum and in the Reptile Garden. We've stopped there many times with grandkids and kids and all that, but haven't written about them that many times through the years because I guess we try to surprise our readers and we just think everybody knows everything about those places. So we've written about them, but not extensively. Mm-hmm. But it slowly dawned on us that a lot of places like that are closing around the country. Some of them have closed right here in South Dakota. These old style roadside attractions, and it dawned on us that, you know, we're pretty lucky that these are still going strong, and we wondered why are they going strong, and we thought there might be some entrepreneurial business lessons to be learned if we stopped and really picked the brains of the people who are making those things work.
Paul, tell us one of your like early takeaways. What were some of those business strategies that you learned?
Well, I learned that for a business to continue in the same field, in the same family, you need to have family members who want to continue it. Mm-hmm. And I think we've all met people who have tried to continue family businesses or family farms who thought it was their obligation, and yet their heart just wasn't in it. These three places, you know, they've all designated family members who know the history and the culture of the places in and out, and they want to devote themselves to making sure they survive in the same family.
Mm-hmm. I'm struck by a quote from the first of these sites that you feature, Pioneer Auto Show in Murdo. I'm not sure which one of you wants to start. Maybe Bernie, we'll start with you. Tell us about Grandpa Dave, speaking of family members.
Yeah, and he kind of gives credit to his dad for starting that thing in the early 50s when his dad started to collect some old cars. But I think we all know it was really Dave Geisler, now 83 years old, who was, as a very young man, and even now today, he's the ringman, the ringleader of that place. There's no question about it. He's had a couple strokes. He's in some health issues, and he's in his early to mid-80s. But he's still the boss, and it's a show. And if you sit in the restaurant with him and have a cup of ice cream with chocolate on it, like he likes to do, up on the big screen above it, they constantly replay the American Picker television shows that he's been on. and he's a celebrity. He says people come and recognize him, and he can talk cars with anybody, strangers and friends. Most of them they're only strangers once there. So, I mean, he's a showman, and Paul, isn't that another thing we learned? I mean, these people are often very humble South Dakotans, down to earth, hardworking South Dakotans. Yet they all know they're putting on a show. That it's about entertainment first, and in every place we stopped, I think it was pretty evident that they put showmanship and treating customers with really great hospitality. That's number one.
That's absolutely right. As Dave said, museums are old and dusty, but we are a show, and that would be true of Reptile Gardens and the Waldreg as well.
Right.
And Sarah Husted told me something that I thought was really interesting. She says they constantly teach the young people that work there to remember that when a traveler comes in, they're probably far from home, hundreds of miles from home, and they're maybe a little bit homesick or a little lonely, and they really need an eye contact and a friendly face and a warm greeting, because that's really what we're here. That's what we're here for, she tells them. And I thought that was really telling too.
Yeah.
I thought that too.
And Sarah Husted, being part of the family that works at Wall Drug, so much is kind of colored by the last year that we've had with the pandemic. I'm curious, with some of these sites, how big did that kind of shadow loom over the operation, these family operations that they've been trying to keep going for generations at this point?
They all had stories about 2020 and how they had to adapt. I think sometimes we think of those institutions, because that's what they are. They're businesses, but they're just institutional part of South Dakota, it seemed like. Mm. But they almost seem like they're too big to fail, and they're all on these busy highways. But they can tell you stories of other times where they've had to adapt to weather conditions, the gas crisis of the 1970s. They're always thinking a couple steps ahead. What do we do if? And, so, for example, they simplified their menu in Wall Drug because they had a smaller staff. Instead of having people crammed together in bleachers to watch alligator wrestling, they let customers feed the alligators on a string flung over the fence, just to create some social distancing. And, just very, very adaptive.
Yeah, Myrtle, at Myrtle, they welcomed campers in their big parking lot because a lot of the campgrounds were closed up and down I-90, and the RVers didn't have any place to stop. So they found a way to reach out to campers and said, we got space here, come on and just pull in. And the campers were really good about making sure they spent some money, ate at the restaurant, but they're such good community people that now they're worried that they've got these campers and now want to come and stay in the parking lot, but they don't want to hurt the campgrounds that are now reopened up and down the interstate. So that's a kind of a dilemma for the folks at Myrtle. And I would guess in other cases they made changes in accommodations last year, and now they're wondering, are these changes we want to continue with in the future, or are they something we need to change back?
Yeah.
Well, I regret to inform you both that the only one of these sites that I have not yet visited in all my years driving around South Dakota has been the Reptile Gardens. Not managed to visit them yet. What's something kind of new that you would want to highlight for if there's any folks unfortunate like me that haven't managed to get in the door? What's new there in these institutions, and how have they managed to thrive?
Well, as I said, they've done some things to create social distancing, like changing the alligator show, changing the bird show. It's big. Most of it's outdoors. You feel fine and safe there. And I think one thing that always surprises people about Reptile Gardens Yeah, we know it's full of snakes. It's the world's biggest reptile collection. But it's beautiful gardens as well. And as we wrote in the story, if you have a thing where you don't want to be near snakes, you can go there and just enjoy the plant life and outdoors. It's a beautiful spot.
They have the landscaping. It is like an ornamental garden, and they've got, you know, Black Hills and Western South Dakota plants and fossils and all that. But they also, didn't they say, Paul, I think they said they plant 40,000 flowers in the spring every year.
Yeah.
That's a lot of flowers. So it's beautiful. Sure you could just walk around the grounds and never see a reptile, and you'd enjoy that kind of it.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And if you don't like reptiles, they have a great prairie dog town, too.
And a bald eagle living happily, and I think he was injured, a big bald eagle living in a cage that you can get pictures of, eyeball to eyeball, and all sorts of cool things. And, of course, the tortoises are the big hit.
You can read more about these roadside thrivers in the July-August edition of South Dakota Magazine. Our guests have been Bernie Hunhoff and Paul Higby. Bernie Hunhoff, thanks again for joining us. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Jackie. Thanks, Paul.
And Paul Higby, thanks to you as well.
Yeah, good talking to you.
Music Matters is a new series that focuses on how music matters to our community and the things that really matter to our artists. Hosted by Apollonia Davalos, you can find Music Matters on SDPB's YouTube channel or by going to our Facebook page. In this first episode of Music Matters, Apollonia visits with a Nebraska-born singer-songwriter whose album Dirty South ascended to the number one spot on the Billboard Country Albums sales chart during its debut week.
Today, we connect with country music artist Lucas Hoag. Earning a number one spot on Billboard Country Music charts, Lucas has won our hearts with his grounded lyrics, support of our troops overseas, and his commitment to composing audio novels to stand the test of time. Ladies and gentlemen, Music Matters is proud to introduce the one and only Lucas Hoag.
I believe music matters in so many different ways. To me, it's the universal language. It breaks down barriers for communication in other ways that, you know, normally you might not be able to communicate with that person or that group of people. And as soon as you start playing some music, it's just a different language. It just speaks to everyone. I guess if I had to pinpoint an epiphany moment in my music career, it'd be at a very, very young age when I realized that music was going to be able to take me everywhere in this world. And I realized very, very early on that when I started learning these instruments and I picked up this guitar and it just started coming to me naturally, that my guitar was going to be my passport out of my little small town of Hubble, and it was going to take me all over the world, but I had no idea exactly how far it was going to take me. The rhythm in my chest, you took away my prayers, baby, just say yeah. Definitely have been some incidences where people have hit me on social media and said that this song or that song has helped them get out of a down point in their life, or you know, they've used it in their wedding and it really pinpointed a time stamp their life, you know, in that moment in time. But there was this moment where I was doing a cowboy church out in Pueblo, Colorado, and I had just finished it, and they were live streaming this song over the radio station that I had just written for this lady who was in hospice care, and it was called How Was I to Know. And I just finished doing this service, and this lady comes pulling up to the church, and she said, I just heard your song on the radio, and I was contemplating whether or not I was going to take my life. And she said, I heard that song, and it stopped her in her tracks, and she's still doing great, better than she ever was. She credits it to that song, How Was I to Know, which I get goosebumps every time I hear that story, because if that's the only thing my music has ever done is save that one life, to me, that's pretty amazing. Well, performing overseas for our troops is something that's near and dear to my heart to begin with. A lot of my family was in the military. My dad was in the Air Force. My uncle was an MP in Vietnam, in the Marines, and so on, down to my cousins who are still in the military today. So I knew that, you know, at a young age, I thought I wanted to go into the military, but then I realized very quickly that I was nowhere, shape, or form wired to be in the military. I'm just not that good of a person, I guess, because they are the best of us. And I knew I wanted to give back in some way, shape, or form. And I think that this was the only way that I was going to be able to do that. And I give 2 weeks of my life, that's nothing, right, to go overseas and look our service men and women in the face and tell them thank you for everything they do, because if it's not for them over there protecting our freedoms here, we can't do what we want to do with our lives on American soil. So I love our service men and women dearly, and going overseas every single year has just increased that love and respect, because the loyalty, the dedication, the sacrifice that all these men and women do for us is beyond compare. And getting to see exactly what they go through day in and day out intensifies that respect for what they do for us. So I'm going to keep doing it as long as I possibly can, because I'm very honored that they continue to ask me to come back and perform for them. I grew up in a super small town of 44 people in rural Nebraska called Hubble, Nebraska. And my mom and dad were very, very active in music, and my mom's a short story writer. She writes poetry and songs on her own as well, so I came by that part very, very naturally. And we grew up in this really small church where maybe at the peak of the congregation there was 15 people in this little one-room church, you know. And when they would go do like worship music and stuff like that and go practice with the preacher at the parsonage, they'd take me, I was just a little kid, and they kind of sit me in the corner to my own devices. And one day I remember the preacher bringing like a electronic little drum set, right, like a little pad, and she'd sit me in the corner so I could play with it. And all of a sudden I was keeping perfect time with what they were singing, and she looks over at me, she's like, he's keeping like perfect time with what we're singing and playing. And after that, she took me into the high school and introduced me to the band teacher and said, you might want to, you know, help this kid along. He's got something natural about his music ability. And after that, I knew that music was part of me, and I wanted to keep that alive and really cultivate that. So definitely family and friends and all the things that helped me cultivate that music career is right there in that little small town of Hubble, Nebraska.
Lucas, thank you so very much for your time, your wisdom, and really allowing us to let in on your personal journey.
This is my pleasure. Thank you for having me. I really appreciated talking with you, and looking forward to all that you do for everyone. It's pretty cool.
And you can watch Music Matters, hosted by Apollonia Davalos, on SDPB's YouTube channel or by going to our Facebook page.